It's Suburban Secrets with Stanislav.
Hello, this is Suburban Secrets episode 4 with Chandler West. Chandler and I went to college together. We worked on the school newspaper together, and now he's one of the best photographers I know. Homeboy gets work done, it's really intimidating. And I never really knew the details of this story, only vaguely that Chandler had certain health problems at some point and received a transplant. But when I asked him to tell the story on this podcast, he said it's actually his mission to share the story as much as possible. So you might notice that Chandler tells the story pretty quickly and thoroughly, and hopefully you can keep up. Also, beginning with this episode and moving forward, I'm going to have different outro music every time, mostly local or up-and-coming artists that I come across in my adventures. Basically, just going to stick to musicians who won't send me a cease and desist letter for copyright infringement, because hopefully they actually appreciate the exposure. And today's feature artist is Peekaboos, a punk band here in Chicago that I've been paying attention to lately because they're seriously crushing it and their shows are a lot of fun. And if you're not going to listen to the whole episode, even though you should, at least skip to the end and check out Let's Talk About Your Big Butt by the Peekaboos off their album Stay Positive. But until then, I bring you Chandler West.
All right, so yeah, when I was in high school, I was about 16 or something. I got really sick. My whole family got pretty sick. We all had like a flu going on, you know, coughing and being lethargic and all that. And everybody kind of got over it, and I never did. And was just kind of really sick, and it was coughing a lot. And so I decided we all decided that I probably had asthma. And I needed to go get like an inhaler and that whole thing. And so I went to one of those like, you know, in and out clinics on the corner and did a checkup, and she was doing the whole checkup things, you know, checking your pulse. And I don't remember all the things you do, but I remember she got to my chest and was listening to it with her stethoscope. And then she kind of just sat there and she sat there. And then she sat there for a little bit longer. Finally, she stopped and she was like, has anybody ever told you you have an irregular heartbeat? And I was like, no. I mean, I think that would have come up, you know, because I had some health problems before that. So, like, I was pretty familiar with the doctor's office. So I was like, no, definitely never heard that one before. And she was like, all right, well, I need you to go to Deaconess Hospital, like, right now. Like right now. And so we hopped in the car and drove down the street to there and went and got a EKG done, and that kind of started a whole whirlwind of things from there. Then I was rushed from that hospital essentially to Oklahoma Children's Hospital, where I learned first that I had a form of congestive heart failure that was called an idiopathic cardiomyopathy, which the idiopathic means that they don't know why or what caused it. And cardiomyopathy means like a swollen heart tissue. So basically my heart had swollen to such a size that it was crushing the other organs around it, which was causing the coughing and all of these other things. We could best decided that maybe that came from the virus that my whole family got, and somehow it ended up getting to my heart when it didn't others. But I crashed the next day, I think it was, which was ironically September 11th, I remember. So they started, they came in one morning and were,
was it the anniversary of September 11th?
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Or the September 11th?
No, it wasn't the September. It was the anniversary of September 11th, 2006. Yeah, I should have clarified that. But it came into play because we had to get on a plane. And I remember my grandma, who's an intense worrywart that freaks out about everything, just didn't like that idea. And I was just thinking how silly that was. Like, I think we got bigger problems to worry about here than the bad juju that goes along with that. But they started prepping me for surgery. They came in the morning. We're doing like the normal tests, that they would do, you know, drawing blood and stuff. And I said, oh, something's wrong. I feel weird, you know. And the nurse had like this panic look on her face, like, you know, I didn't expect her to freak out that quickly, but I think maybe she knew something was wrong. And then everything kind of got hazy and I passed out. And I remember waking up a couple minutes later and they had the defibrillator pads like in their hands and we're like warming up and up and we're ready to go. And I guess I came to just in time to save myself from that. So then that came up two options. They only had two options from that point. They could put you on an LVAD machine, which is a left ventricular assist device, I believe. It's just a machine that pumps for your heart for you. But in Oklahoma and in 2006, they weren't very good at it. And so they had a machine that would extend that would work for you for about 7 days. And it was like a very definitive, like 7 day mark. And I've never really been told what happens on the eighth day, but they said you have 7 days essentially. And they have 7 days to find you a new heart and, or else, I suppose. And so the other option was them metaflighting me to St. Louis Children's Hospital, which is what ended up happening. And was probably the first of many things that came together to keep me going. Otherwise, I don't think that those 7 days would have gone very well. But ended up in St. Louis Children's Hospital for about 3 or 4 months now, I think. I was there, two of which I don't think I ever left my bed. I was just, you know, bedridden. As one of my doctors called it. I had like heart failure green was the color of my skin. And I remember walking in, he just goes, wow, you look like shit. We're going to have to fix that. And so I did that for a while and they did a couple surgeries and things like that. They gave me a pacemaker defibrillator that kind of was like a stopgap for about a year. So I was able to actually then go home and return to some semblance of normal life for almost a year there. Before things started to turn bad again and had to go back to St. Louis. And the weird thing about that to me was I called and, you know, I said I was getting bad and it was kind of an expected thing. At some point you're going to get sick again and we're going to do this. And so I called and kind of told them and they're like, all right, well, we'll have you come in a week from Tuesday and we'll, fly up here and we'll start things or whatever, which is a really weird thing to tell somebody because it's essentially just setting a timer for your life there, you know. And my friends were also going in high school, they were taking the ACT and applying for college and things like that, so I didn't tell them originally because I didn't want them to be consumed by me and what was going on, so I kind of just kept it to myself a little bit. And sitting at the house and essentially just thinking about this clock ticking down until, you know, something happens was too much for us, me and my family. So we ended up just hopping in the car and driving ourselves to the hospital like a week early. So I actually walked into the hospital and just walked up to the counter and said, I'd like to check myself in for a heart transplant, which is strange. And I was there for a couple weeks. I'd been accruing time on the donor list for that entire year period before that. And so I had quite a bit of time under me. And the doctors in St. Louis are amazing. And part of the reason that they pushed to make things happen as quickly as they did was I was 17 at the time, about a couple months before my birthday in January, where I would have turned 18 and then been knocked onto the adult list, which is a more intimidating thing. And so they immediately put you on. There's different rankings, I think everybody knows, on the donor list, and it's broken down into like 1A, 2A, 1B, 2B, I think. And that's determined by what kind of medications you're on and how needy of an organ you are. So they put me on a lot of these medications, though I didn't necessarily quite need them yet, but they did it so that I would be bumped up onto a higher status on the list, which just goes into their intelligence, I think. It was clever planning. So I pretty quickly found a donor on December 4th, 2007, at like 3 a.m. or something like that. And then I spent a week in the hospital after that. The thing about heart transplants as opposed to others is it's kind of like dropping a new engine in a car is the way to describe it. The car is in good shape, but the motor is broken. So as soon as you put in a new motor that works, it it, you know, it snaps back into place or whatever. Whereas with lungs, if your lungs are bad, it kind of creates a domino effect. Your lungs aren't working, so that causes pulmonary problems that causes your heart to react and things like that. So it kind of cascades down and causes a lot of things, but it doesn't work necessarily that way with the heart. So as soon as I got the heart, you're just almost immediately better, aside from a few hiccups and things. But I ended up only spending like a week in the hospital after the transplant, then a week in like a halfway house type of apartment that we had in the city because we weren't from there.
With like drug dealers and ex-cons?
No, not quite. It was actually pretty nice, but it was like, you know, it was in St. Louis, which was pretty sketchy at the time. But it was just a little apartment we had that was adjacent to the hospital. And then I got to go home like right a couple days before Christmas, actually. So the entire process from the day I checked myself in to the day I got to fly back home was a month to the day, I think. So that was pretty amazing that you could go through something so intense so quickly like that. But that was kind of the abridged version of the whole thing. The last part of the story that I'll mention that's the important part to me is the donor, my donor, who has become a huge deal to me, obviously. Her name was Lauren Lynn Luth. She was actually only 7 days younger than I was. Her birthday was on the 20th, and mine is on the 14th, so 6 days, I guess that is. And so we were pretty close in that. And I wasn't always as comfortable with the idea. It kind of freaked me out for a long time. And I remember just kind of trying to tell myself in my head that I liked the idea of just imagining that the doctors just fixed whatever was wrong. They said, oh, they just went in, you know, and they fixed it, and now I'm okay. I didn't like the idea of them actually, like, you know, taking something away and taking something from somebody else, and that this person is now gone. And it was too much. So, that was my thought for a while, and that was just kind of what I was sticking with. And they have a system where they don't let you contact the family in any way for a year, because everybody kind of needs time, I think. And so I wasn't even going to think about it until that year mark was what I was doing. But actually, at like 6 months or so, I got a letter in the mail from her mom, and it was very censored. They censor a lot of things, so you don't get much information out of it. But I became kind of consumed with the idea then all of a sudden. I just couldn't, you know, I'd been putting it off for so long, but now it was, you know, it was right there. So I kind of became really into it. And my family knew a little bit about the donor. They tell you basic things, like if it was a male or a female and about what age, and that's about it. But I didn't even want them to tell me that. We had a strict rule amongst my doctors and amongst my family not to tell me anything, because I didn't want to know. And I think, I don't know what it was about it, but I was always afraid I would hear that it was like a 45-year-old fat man or something like weird. And I don't know why that visual always kind of freaked me out. I was like, I don't know what it was. And also, it didn't feel right. Like, whenever I would think about it, that didn't fit into how I felt or something. And so I got this letter, and so I started thinking about it more. And I remember I had this moment that's one of the weirder moments I have ever had. And I've heard similar things from other people kind of like this. But I remember I was driving somewhere in my car after this happened, and I was thinking, wow, I wonder what she was like. I wonder, you know, I don't know, what her friends were like, what she did. I just, you know, just became very interested in this person who was so important to me, but, you know, that I would never actually meet. And I got about halfway to where I was going, and I realized I didn't know why I was picturing like a young girl. I kept actually phrasing the sentences in my head like that. I wonder what she was like, I wonder what she did. And I thought, well, I have no idea why I've been doing this. Why would I have no reason to believe that. Like I said, it could be a 40-year-old man. And so I finally called my mom. I was at a birthday party, and, you know, I just kind of zoned out in the corner somewhere and texted my mom. I was like, all right, I need you to tell me. I need to know. And she said it was a 17-year-old girl. And it was just like, it was weird that, like, I can't describe the feeling, but it's like you just kind of had this, you just knew kind of thing, you know. And I'm not one to really get into that kind of those feeling and, like, things like that. But
sounds pretty new agey.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I've, like I said, I heard people that I met a person one time that said that she got visions from her donor. And I remember immediately thinking, wow, I have to get away from this crazy person now. But then after that experience, because it was just such a vivid, weird feeling to me, that now I do maybe put a little more credit towards it. I don't know. But and then, so like I said, I got this letter and I became kind of consumed with it. And I did one of the creepier things that I think I've ever done, but it worked out. And I guess it was kind of, you know, the inquisitive side of me that's works well for being a journalist, I suppose. But I knew enough things. I knew she was 17. She died somewhere around December 4th. She had to be somewhere in the region of St. Louis. It couldn't be, you know, too far. And her mom's name was Mary. Those were the four, like, things I knew. And I knew that those things had to be enough to be able to figure out who it was. And it turns out you can look up all of the people that die in the Social Security database. It'll have, like, their names, age, and what their birthdays and death day. And so I was able to look up 17-year-old girls in a region around St. Louis, and I found about five. And then I was able to go through obituaries to find who the one that had a mom named Mary. And then I found their phone number, and I had their phone number. I had the phone number of these people. And I took me like a day of just staring at it, you know, whatever. And I finally, because I had written back to them, you know, another very censored letter. So they knew my name, but they didn't know anything else. And the best I could come up with for the forming of my sentence when I called was, I said, "Hi, I'm Chandler. Do you know who I am?" And that was all I could, like, utter out of my mouth. And she just, like, paused and she said, "Yes, I do." And, like, you know, she was on the other line. So she hung up with the people and we ended up talking. And now, since then, it's been 5 years since the transplant now. Her family, Lauren's family, and I have become very close. I visit them, you know, frequently. They actually just drove down to Oklahoma when I was home last time and stayed with my family and I for a couple days. They came to my graduation, all of this stuff. And, you know, her mom texts me every so often just to check in. And we refer to her as my heart mom and all of those things, which is kind of corny, but, you know, I mean, they're really important to me, and it's really awesome. And I know a lot of people don't get that experience with through, like, these things. I met a guy that tried to write a letter to his people, and their situation was sort of different and very sad, but he just got a response back that was, "Don't ever contact me again. I never want to hear from you. I want nothing to do with you." And, you know, it's understandable, obviously, but it was also very hard for him to hear that, you know, that took a toll on him quite a bit. So I'm very appreciative of the relationship we have. And, I have the tattoo, I don't know if you know, it's three L's, which is Lauren's initials. And, she was kind of famous for, she loved her name, her initials. She was very into it. And so she would write the three L's, or even to go to the point of engraving them on walls throughout her little town of Manila, Iowa, of like 400-500 people or something like that. So that was kind of her thing, so it seemed appropriate to try to pay tribute to her at least in a little bit. So
you mentioned to me that sharing the story is sort of a mission of yours.
Yeah.
And is that related to the tribute you're trying to pay to Lauren?
Yeah, I mean, it's just a crazy thing. It's a weird, it's not a normal situation, but it's great. I mean, I couldn't have ever imagined I'd been able to do the things that I've done since then. I mean, sitting in a hospital room for 2 months on end, and I remember, you know, the janitor coming into my room and just being immensely jealous of this guy who had to clean my garbage. Because, you know, after his day of cleaning disgusting hospital garbage, he gets to go home and do whatever it is that he wants to do. And I have no idea what that was, but I knew I would just do anything to be able to do that, just being confined to that bed. And so I remember I wouldn't even have allowed myself to imagine that one day I would, you know, now be living in Chicago and doing all the things I've done, be able to travel abroad and do all of these things. And I wouldn't have gotten that chance if it weren't for Lauren and for what she has done for me, and, you know, what those people, these donors, do for all of us. And so it's important to raise awareness of it, because it's still not, there's still way more people waiting than there are donors. And I think it's kind of a problem in our country, in a lot of countries. And I just heard another one in Canada, for instance, and another country just signed on to the same system of the opposite of what we do here, in, which is you have to sign up to be a donor. In other countries, it's becoming more common for it to be you're a donor unless you request not to be, which I think is the perfect system. Because I don't have anything against people who don't want to be donors, though I disagree with it. But in all honesty, when I was younger and I was, you know, uninformed about it, I think I was against it. It just, you know, it just didn't seem, I don't know, I was just one of the, or, you know, ignorant people about it. So if you are against it, then that's fine, whatever. But I don't think it should be the default for you to. And so, but, you know, that's another topic, I guess. What my point is that just trying to raise any kind of awareness to get those people to sign up. I mean, you can, one person donating can save 9 other people or more, you know, and it's just such an amazing thing. And it's not something that's taken for granted, which is another mission of mine, is to try to show the appreciation we all have for it. I have some projects in mind that I want to do in that way of kind of saying thank you. You know, I've worked in some groups and worked with the Donate Life groups and stuff like that, and you meet these people and it's like, you know, none of these people get these gifts, or at least none that I've come across, and then spend their days sitting on the couch or selling drugs or, you know, getting in bar fight or whatever. You know, they're all these very driven people that are out there doing, trying to use whatever time that they've been given to do the best that they can to whatever it is they do. I have a friend that writes books and goes out and does speeches, and they're all just, you know, it's like, they're just like, holy shit, well, I shouldn't be here in the first place, so now I'm gonna do something with it, you know. And so that's what I kind of mean by, I feel like this is kind of my job to do that. So
you and I met at a Catholic school, and I don't really know your spiritual background, mm-hmm. but has this affected your faith or spirituality?
No, I wasn't a very religious person to begin with. I mean, I would say I'm more, I don't know, even spiritual doesn't sound, I just don't like the way that sounds. But, you know, I do believe in some kind of, like, you know, universal system of something, but I guess I'm more agnostic than anything. My family is Catholic, but kind of Catholic with air quotes is what I, you know, how I usually feel. My dad went to Catholic school his whole life, and I think the old joke is, if you went to Catholic school your whole life, why aren't you Catholic? And the answer is, because I went to Catholic school my whole life. And so that was the thing, is dad spent all his years going to Catholic, going to mass, so he never wanted to go when we were kids, so we never went. So I was just kind of not into it, and it just didn't really, you know, I don't know. I put a lot more faith in people and humanity and things like that. And my family is not so much that way. And, you know, and I don't, you know, I didn't disregard it, and I don't have a problem with it. But, you know, they were saying, oh, we need to pray, you know, and say thanks for all of these things. And maybe you do, and maybe I should. But in my head, I'm just thinking, no, we need to thank Dr. Gandhi, the amazing surgeon I had, or you have to thank the Luth family for what they've done for us. And, you know, it's more of a tangible thing. It's like, no, these people are here, these are the ones that did it, and you need to thank them. And so that's kind of how I look at these things.
Did the illness, mm-hmm. Did it set you back in school?
No. My high school was pretty amazing with working with me. I did a little bit of work to try to stay current when I was in the hospital, but frankly, when you're in the hospital, the last thing you care about is a math problem or, you know, an English paper, so I didn't do too much. But they worked with me, and I had to take, like, an extra class, I think, but I was still actually able to graduate on time, so I got out, not with great grades, obviously, but, you know, but I was proud of what I walked away with for, you know, I dropped out of school for a year and was still able to walk out with like a 2.5 GPA from high school. So, you know, that's nothing to, you know, it's nothing, it's very impressive, but I was pretty comfortable with it. And so it was a little interesting when I got around to applying to colleges. I've started telling the story more to people recently because I'm proud of where I've ended up, but I actually got rejected from Loyola originally. And I know a lot of the people we go to school, they all kind of shit on Loyola. It's like, oh, they let everybody in. And in my head, I'm like, no, they don't. They really don't. I swear to God, they don't. I got flat out rejected. And I think the reason was is because it showed on my transcript that I dropped out for a year and I had a 2.5 GPA. And frankly, on paper, I don't look very like a good student or person. So luckily, I had a really dedicated guidance counselor that just wasn't cool with that, and I think she badgered them afterwards. And one Saturday I was sitting on my couch and I actually got a phone call from one of the assistant deans of the of Loyola just calling to apologize for their mistakes and asking me if I would come to school there or whatever, which was pretty cool. So I also take my time at Loyola, or I always really appreciated that too, because I didn't feel like I shouldn't be here at all, and I certainly shouldn't be at the school, so I was always very appreciative of all of it.
Just to touch on the new agey stuff.
Yeah.
I recently was just talking to a friend of mine who referenced one of those really bizarre stories about a person who, just a regular person, say an American, who has head trauma or something, and then when they recover from this head trauma, suddenly they speak with like a Scottish accent.
Yeah.
And you mentioned suddenly knowing that your donor was a girl. Mm-hmm. Did you notice any other inexplicable changes in yourself after the operation?
I don't know. I think it's such a gradual thing. I've heard from my family and things, and they say that I was certainly different coming out of it. I don't know if And I feel like I definitely am, you know. I don't know if that's what part of the experience that is. Is it because of this person, or is it just from the experience? I don't really know. But, and I remember when I went to visit Manila, the town that she was from, and like kind of wondering how that would go. And, you know, I think I talked to her family and they're like, does anything seem familiar? Because, you know, they were kind of curious about it too. Like, how does this work? We don't really know. And it wasn't necessarily that, but I did feel this like strong sense of peace, like almost kind of things weren't familiar, but it was very home-like. Like, it was very kind of calming to be there almost. And the other kind of weird thing to me was just like, I don't know. It was kind of this weird like connection. We would always seem to be kind of like in line. I don't know. I would have a day where I was just like, you know, down in the dumps or whatever. And on those days, it would just kind of, you know, make me self-reflect. So I would usually end up calling or texting them or something to see how they were doing. And they would kind of do the same. And it always seemed like those days would come about when something had happened on one side or the other. You know, I would be really down in the dumps and I would call her mom, and I don't remember the instance, but something had just happened. Like, I think it was Lauren's senior pictures had just shown up in the mail that day, or, you know, something that had caused her to be very upset and kind of really bring, or, you know, some legal trouble, because they had some legal things that they were working through, had come up. And so we always kind of had this weird, like synced up type of thing. And that always was kind of inexplainable to me also. But, I don't know. It's very odd for sure. So I don't know.
That's amazing. Well,
it's weird.
Yeah. Thanks, Chandler.
Yeah.
Not I'm trying to use that phone.